Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For a whole lot of people, alcohol is a real problem, an addiction that's very hard to shake. For 75 years now, for millions of people, Alcoholics Anonymous, AA, has been the path for trying. 12 steps promoted in 55,000 AA groups around the country. How's it work when it works and why? This hour, On Point Alcoholics Anonymous at 75, and what science and AA members have to say about its record. You can join the conversation. Is that you at the AA meeting? Is it working? How? Why? Why not? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Brendan Koerner, contributing editor to Wired magazine. Koerner's long article, Secret of AA, After 75 Years We Don't Know How It Works, appeared in Wired's June issue. Brendan, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's a big piece, really interesting. A lot of people in AA will know a lot of it, but those of us not may not. And for everybody, I think you're chasing down the scientists to ask them what's going on here is really fascinating. But I wish you'd take us back for a minute. We're talking about anniversary 75th. Take us back first to December, 14th, 1934, and AA founder Bill Wilson in Towns Hospital in, it's a Manhattan detox center, given the Belladonna cure. What was that, and who was he, and what happened on that night, Brendan?
Well, he was a man who had once been a very promising and somewhat wealthy Wall Street speculator, and his whole career had been ruined by his addiction to alcohol. And he'd been in detox a few times before, and this was his third time at Towns Hospital. And when he showed up at the hospital, he was in very bad shape due to withdrawal. And so he was given, as you said, the Belladonna cure.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been on a real bad bender, and that was kind of his habit. Every day when he finished work, he hit all the bars and speakeasies. So he came in, shakes, all the symptoms of withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
Given this hourly infusions of a drug made from a plant with hallucinogenic berries, and this was supposed to get him through the withdrawal pains.
This is the so-called Belladonna cure.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And while he was undergoing this treatment, he was visited by a friend named Ebby Thatcher.
Mm-hmm.
And Thatcher had been one of Wilson's old drinking buddies. They'd spent many a night knocking back whiskeys and telling tall tales. But a little bit earlier, Thatcher, just a few weeks or a few months earlier, I guess, mm-hmm. had joined the Oxford Group, a Christian movement, and had a spiritual epiphany and had kicked alcohol, was no longer drinking, was completely stone-cold sober. And he urged Wilson, he said, look, you know, you have to admit that your addiction to alcohol has you licked and that you have to get down, surrender to God, and he'll remove your compulsion to drink. And Wilson was a devout agnostic and thought this was mm-hmm. completely idiotic, wanted nothing to do with it, and kind of just nodded his head and said, right, whatever. But that night he was on his bed and he was having a lot of inner turmoil. He saw the terrible shape his life was in. He knew that he might be institutionalized if things got worse.
And he's in a detox center as this is going on. He's in bed. He's on hallucinogenics. He's on the Belladonna cure.
Yes, he is. And he decides to try Thatcher's advice. He gets down on his knees and he shouts out and he says, "If God, if you're here, reveal yourself to me and I'll do anything if you do that." And that's when he had the his own epiphany, when God actually visited him in his room. He saw a white light, and he would never drink again.
He wrote, or later said, you're right, it seemed to me in the mind's eye that I was on a mountain, and that a wind not of air but of spirit was blowing. And then it burst upon me that I was a free man. And from that quite amazing night, all of this was born?
Yeah, I think that a big part of this was Wilson had been one of the worst drunks you could imagine. And having been cured, as he said, so totally and so suddenly, he felt it was his duty to share this revelation with other people in his predicament. And it was the following year, the following May and June, that he was in Akron, Ohio, on business. And he met through an Oxford Group meeting that was there, a man named Bob Smith, a physician in Akron, who was also a secret alcoholic. And so Bill Wilson sat down with him and kind of shared the advice that Abby Thatcher had given him, saying, you have to acknowledge your problem, say that it's licked you, surrender to God, and he will remove your compulsion to drink. And on June 10th, 1935, Dr. Bob did that, and that's become the official founding date of AA.
And so we come to the 75th anniversary in the year 2010. How did it roll out? How did he get the 12 steps? And what was the public reception? I mean, we know today 55,000 of these groups around the country, never mind the world meeting. But what about the 12 steps? Where'd that come from and how was it received?
Well, a little bit of a hodgepodge. He had a couple influences. A major one was the Oxford group, which he joined on Thatcher's advice. He initially, when he wrote those steps, had only six of them. And they were pretty much, I wouldn't say cribbed, but heavily influenced by Oxford group precepts of meeting in small groups, surrendering to God, doing good works. But he didn't like six. He thought they were a little bit too compact. And so he played around with it a little bit, and he finally came up with 12. And the number, the significance of that number to him was because there were 12 apostles. Mm. 12 steps made sense to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just kind of clicked at that moment for Bill Wilson.
Did the public glom onto this right away? How did it come to be, you know, sort of the thing that people think of when they come to think of treating alcoholism?
Well, they got some very good early press. There is a landmark 1941 newspaper story by a man named Jack Alexander, who went in and kind of visited some of these early meetings when it was still a very, very small organization. And he really had incredibly encouraging, enthusiastic response to what was going on. And obviously the people that are changed by AA become such adherents and such acolytes for it that Alexander was incredibly impressed by their enthusiasm. That, and there was also a catcher for the Cleveland Indians who came out and said, you know, broke anonymity and said that this really saved my life and made me a better baseball player. And that was a huge news story and really gave them a lot of good publicity.
Here's the voice of AA founder Bill Wilson himself. This was in 1965, talking about the need to put the group above the individual and what happens if people stray once they get on the program.
Every AA member knows that he has to conform to the principles of recovery. His life actually depends upon obedience to spiritual principles. If he deviates too far, the penalty is sure and swift. He sickens and finally dies.
Bill Wilson, the founder, 75th anniversary this year of AA. So you've talked with a lot of people in the scientific community about, you know, what goes on in AA meetings and success rates and how it works and what's understood and not understood about how and when it works. Let's just start with the numbers. You know, how successful is it?
Well, that's really the million-dollar question that no one can answer, because AA is incredibly difficult to study in a scientific manner. You know, we talk about alcoholism as a disease. When we're talking about treatments or therapies or drugs for diseases, we test them in clinical trials versus placebo, see if they perform better than placebo. We can't really do that with AA for a variety of reasons. The anonymity, the nature of the organization, its open-door policy for members to come and go as they please. Mm-hmm. And also the sense that if people are in it, a lot of people respond very negatively to AA. There's a very high dropout rate. It's a pretty severe program. And a lot of people, when they pass through it, just can't get into it, go to a few meetings, drop out, either resume drinking or try another solution. So it's very, very difficult to give a reliable estimate for efficacy of AA.
I mean, you report the success rate is quoted anywhere from 5% to 75%. You say both of those sound kind of extreme.
Yeah, the 5% is one that's often cited by skeptics of AA. Well, 75% was a very early estimate by AA itself of its efficacy. As is usually the case, the truth is probably somewhere in the middle.
Brendan, walk us through some of the key points in the 12 steps. They're no secret. You don't have to go to an AA meeting to find them out. What are some of the key steps in the 12 steps?
Well, I think the most famous and celebrated ones are the first ones, about admitting you have a problem, that you're basically licked by your problem, and surrendering to God. And then you go through a process of enumerating your faults, sharing them with another person, often your sponsor within the group, then going to those you've wronged during your alcoholic phase and trying to make amends and trying to do good works and minister to others. And the final step is basically live the steps in your life every day and to bring the message of AA to others.
And what does AA mean in the 12 steps when it says God, that you throw yourself, you sort of surrender to a higher power, but it says God right in the 12 steps. What does that mean exactly to AA?
Well, it's interesting. Bill Wilson talks about this pretty straightforwardly in what was called the Big Book, which is the kind of the Bible of AA. Like I said, he was an agnostic when he had a spiritual epiphany. So he understands that a lot of people approach AA skeptically because of the accent on the higher power. So there was this old saw about your higher power needn't be a supernatural being. It can be something as simple as a doorknob. In meetings I attended, I never heard something that outlandish, but I heard many people say that my higher power is AA itself. My higher power is my sponsor, or my higher power is this church basement we're meeting in. So there is room for those who not want to make the leap of faith to believe in the supernatural.
You know, you would have thought after 75 years you might have some other way that there'd be a pharmaceutical answer that everybody used instead. There are some now, but still AA is still so prominent. Do scientists give that credence? We'll hear from some later in this hour, but do they look at this and say, yeah, this works and there's a reason we can understand for that?
Well, it's difficult. There has been a great deal of research into who it works best for, what kind of the prerequisites are for if you're going to benefit from it or not. But there's also organizational genius to AA. The fact that it's everywhere and it's free has made it really the go-to solution for people.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about AA, Alcoholics Anonymous at 75, and what we understand about the 12-step formula and why it works when it works. Brendan Kerner is with us. He's contributing editor at Wired Magazine. They've published a big story called Secret of AA. After 75 years, we don't know how it works. Joins us from New York. Also with us right now from New York is Bill N. He's a 20-year member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a sponsor there, AA. Offered him to us. It's not that easy to get folks, it's called Alcoholics Anonymous for a reason. People don't use their names and come forward under their full name to talk about it. But Bill is with us. Bill, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Hello.
What's your story with AA?
Quickly in a nutshell, I came to AA as a teenager in high school. Mm-hmm. By then, already a full-blown alcoholic. In and out of AA until I was 23 years old. And I've been sober since I've been 23.
What got you to go into an AA meeting in the first place?
Trouble at school, trouble at home. Come from a long family involved or that suffers from alcoholism generation to generation. And a high school counselor thought that it might help me if I went to an open meeting and maybe understood something about one of my parents' problems. I think he really sent me there so I'd learn about myself. Mm-hmm. Then DWIs, trouble at home, trouble in relationships, all those by the time I was 23 sent me here for good.
I think you had an automobile wreck that ended up injuring a lot of people.
I've been involved in a few car accidents and been arrested for DWI a few times.
So do you still go to the meetings?
I do. I still go to meetings.
Do you plan to do that? Do you expect to do that for life?
Well, I guess I should say that it's a day-at-a-time program. However, my life goes better when I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's being involved in the 12 steps, sponsoring people, having a sponsor, attending meetings. I mean, my life is much different now than it was when I was a 23-year-old coming into Alcoholics Anonymous.
Who do you think it works for, and who doesn't it work for, Bill?
Well, that's a... I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer that question. I don't think, from what I read in our literature, AA never claims to have the corner on the market of recovery from alcoholism. We have something that works for us. I've found that AA works for me. And I've never been part of a more eclectic group of people anywhere in my life, and I live and work in an urban area, than Alcoholics Anonymous, from race, religion, sexual orientation. I'm not sure I could say who it works best for. For me, it works when I do what AA asks of me.
How do you understand the higher power piece of the AA 12 steps?
Well, I'd heard a little bit of the person who was just interviewed, and I myself was an agnostic for a long time, sober. Came to AA pretty agnostic, but I think it's so the beauty of AA that it was just, you know, the book was written in 1939 and founded in 1935, is that it's so open to let people develop. It's kind of the opposite, I find, with most religions, or the religion I was raised in. They tell you who God is or what God looks like, and then to believe in him. And in AA, I've kind of found the opposite, where they tell me to believe in something, and then I can develop my own conception of a higher power. And I think that's really, especially in the changing world today, the real gift of AA.
We've got a lot of comments here, Bill. Here's some from our website. Here's Bob, who says, AA saved my life. Anyone with a drinking problem needs to give AA a try. But then here's another from Gary, who says, I watched AA turn my father from a drunk into a self-righteous religious drunk. The guilt made him angry, and then he became dangerous and violent as well. What do you say, Bill?
I don't think I'm in any position to comment. I'm not a professional, and I'm not in a position to comment on someone else. I can tell you that AA took me, a 23-year-old broken boy, spiritually, physically, mentally, and it somehow gives me a way to become a productive member of society, as long as I'm still willing to live by certain spiritual rules. And you know, I travel on business all the time. I'm an executive for a company in New York. I still look where meetings are, where I'm traveling. I've been able to do things that I thought that just by not drinking, I'd never be able to take part in life or to join in what others do. So, you know, that's not my experience.
I've heard you saying, now I walk through Penn Station in a suit and think I used to live here.
Yes, I sometimes think that the rest of the world that I deal with, obviously people I travel with or go to dinner with, know I don't drink, but whether I decide to let them know I'm a member of AA is a very personal decision. But I think most people, it's hard for them to understand the real, how destructive alcoholism is to one's life. And I often say that I went to the U.S. Open, the tennis matches, maybe 2 years ago, and I was walking with about 7 or 8 people back through Penn Station, returning there. And although they understand I don't drink, it would probably be hard to explain to them that my life took me to a place where I would buy an inexpensive ticket so the police wouldn't kick me out of the waiting room there.
Wow. Bill N., speaking anonymously with us from New York City, a 20-year member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Brendan Kerner is with us from Wired Magazine. He's written a big piece on AA at the year of its 75th anniversary. Let's get some medical, scientific perspective right now on alcoholism and AA. Joining us from Berkeley, California, is Leanne Cascudas. She's senior scientist at the Public Health Institute's Alcohol Research Group, studies the epidemiology of alcohol consumption. Leanne, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
And from Albuquerque, New Mexico, we're joined by Scott Tonnegan, professor at the Center on Alcoholism, Substance Abuse, and Addiction at the University of New Mexico. Scott, thank you for being with us today.
Hello, Tom.
Give us some numbers, Scott. You've done some research. What do you see on alcoholism, AA, and efficacy?
Well, what I first would like to do is congratulate Brendan on a wonderful article. It was very balanced, and that's nice to see. And I also want to acknowledge the support of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism for their interest and commitment to developing effective treatments. There's been a long history of research on Alcoholics Anonymous, beginning really in the mid-40s. And in the last 10 to 15 years, that the level of research has increased dramatically and has also improved dramatically in design and in being able to draw causal inferences. What we see is that clinically, we ought to encourage people to at least sample what AA has to offer, and that approximately, you know, numbers as Brendan mentioned earlier are very hard to come by, but, you know, we find what we call a correlation or an association between attendance and improvement, particularly on measures of abstinence. Researchers have multiple measures of drinking intensity and abstinence and total abstinence and polysubstance use, that we see a generally positive association between attendance and improvement.
But you, I think, have found something like, I don't know, 50 or 80% won't make it to the first-year anniversary in AA. I mean, if they show up, and many never do show up, but many who do show up, within a year, they're gone again.
Well, that's correct. There's been a great deal of work on what we would label affiliation profiles, who is most likely to attend and not attend. And a very robust finding is that the problem severity, as our guest speaker mentioned earlier, is problem severity is a strong predictor, and with severity measured along a number of dimensions.
You mean the more severe, the more likely you are to stick with it or not stick with it?
Well, we think the message resonates, the message of Alcoholics Anonymous resonates more with people who have a higher problem severity, the loss of control and those sort of things.
Can you put a number on the success rate of AA? Is it possible for anybody to?
Well, as Brendan mentioned, that's the million-dollar question. It is very difficult. Scientifically, it's an elusive number. We would like to say that approximately of those people who continue to attend, probably somewhere between 20 and 40, 50% fare much better.
But hard to put a hard number on it. Leanne Cascudas, here's a Facebook comment from Richard. He says, skeptical. Considering AA has offered little or no evidence that their 12-step program actually does anything to help alcoholics, Richard writes, AA should be treated like any other quack treatment. However, because AA is religious, it gets a pass. What do you say, Leanne?
Oh, boy, what a question to throw my way. Thank you, Tom.
Sure.
Well, what you hear over and over again at AA meetings is members saying, you know, it is not a religious program. It is a spiritual program. And I think that what people need to take from that is not that they need to believe in God, but that they need to believe that they're not God. And I think that'll take them a long way. Now, regarding whether it's effective or not, you know, like Scott said and many have written, it kind of depends on who you're studying and how long you follow them and how severe their problems are. But I've reviewed the literature of these kinds of studies and looked at the criterion for establishing scientific evidence and proof, like we used in deciding that, yeah, cigarettes cause lung cancer. Mm-hmm. What were those criteria? And when I look at the literature according to those criteria, I can see why someone would be skeptical, and at the same time, I could see why you would, you know, go to your grave believing that AA is effective. You know, it's really something. There is something for everybody in the numbers. Should I continue on that?
Well, let's hold the numbers right there. And Brendan, let me come to you. Brendan, you brought up the sort of brain structure elements of alcoholism here and some of the thinking about how the AA approach may or may not interact with that. Give us a sense of that, Brendan.
Well, there's a couple things. In an alcoholic brain, one of the parts that's most damaged is the prefrontal cortex, and that's what's basically responsible for regulating behavior. And this is why very hardcore alcoholics are fully aware of the terrible problems and stresses they're causing through their habit, yet they just can't control it. And so one of the theories about the mechanisms by which AA works is that the group, the people that become your new social network kind of are a substitute prefrontal cortex, in that getting up in a room and talking about the problems you've had and the struggles you've had kind of creates the kind of cues for regulation of behavior that your damaged prefrontal cortex cannot provide for you, and it gives it time for that part of your brain to heal.
Amazing. So your brain may lose some plasticity, may lose some function under the effect of alcohol that the group possibly could be supplementing in effect?
That's exactly right. Your prefrontal cortex basically can't send messages to other parts of your brain saying, wait a second, stop this. So being in those church basements and talking these things out kind of spurs the prefrontal cortex to fulfill that mission.
Well, let's hear from some of our listeners. They've got a lot of experience on from many angles here. Spokane, Washington, Carol. Carol, you're on the air.
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Hello.
What's your story, Carol?
Well, I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 21 years. I came into the program at the age of 26. And I have to tell you that my life has never been better. I would agree with the previous comment that this is a spiritual program, not a religious one. For me, I had no clear way of dealing with my problems, not just alcohol, but life in general. And what the program has offered me is what they talk about as design for living, that really addresses the core issues that I had. Alcohol was really not the problem. For me, and I speak only for myself, alcohol was a solution to my life problem. I didn't know how to live and be in harmony with others. And so I used alcohol to sort of self-medicate. And what I was looking for in a bottle, I found in AA. That feeling of, you know, things are going to be okay. One day at a time, I walk through whatever's going on in life, and I now have tools to deal with the way that I felt that made me want to drink.
Carol, how often do you go to an AA meeting? How often?
I go anywhere between 4 to 6 meetings a week on average. Still after this time, and primarily, I mean, I go for a lot of reasons. I enjoy the meetings, number one, but I also am very, very clear that this is not a disease that I've done the steps that did. I'm cured. You know, it's progressive illness. It's fatal, and I really want to stay sober, and so I continue to go because that's part of what I do, but also because I have an obligation for my own self to try and give back what was given. That's one of the steps, is that we try to carry this message to those who are still suffering.
Right. In a design for living, as you say. Carol, in Spokane, thanks for your call. Let me get some more testimony here. Salt Lake City, Utah, RJ, you're on the air. Thanks, Carol. RJ, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty well. What's your story?
I'm sober 33 years. Got sober when I was 26. Alcoholism just destroyed me, led me to suicide attempts. And the part that I'd like to add is I just came from the International in San Antonio, had a wonderful time. But
is that an international AA meeting, RJ?
The International Convention in San Antonio,
okay.
Texas, celebrating 75 years of AA.
I see, okay. Yep.
Anyhow, the point that I'd like to make is the people that founded AA hit upon an answer, and they were very confident about it. And in their literature, it says this is precisely how we recovered, number one. And the other thing they say is rarely has a person failed who thoroughly follows AA's path. Very confident, you'd almost say cocky attitudes, but that's how inspired they were and how much they believe in what they did.
RJ, I appreciate your call as well. Thank you very much there in Salt Lake. And yet, Brendan, you report in your Wired article, quoting you here, a 1999 meta-analysis of 21 existing studies concluded that AA members actually fared worse than drinkers who received no treatment at all. It's hard to know how to put that up against the testimony of those like RJ, like Carol, who say, boy, it saved my life.
Well, it's interesting because there was a flaw in that study, which the authors acknowledge, is that there were many people that were in those studies they looked at that had been at AA because of court mandates, because they'd gotten DWIs or other kind of minor offenses for which AA was prescribed as an alternative form of punishment or correction. And it kind of goes back to what the caller was just saying, is that if, you know, AA believes that if you work the steps honestly and sincerely and every single day, then you will get better. But the flip side of that is that if you're not really if you haven't hit rock bottom, and if you're not going to be there working every day, if you're compelled to be there, it's probably not going to work for you. And in fact, you may have an extremely negative reaction to it. And so when you do hit rock bottom, eventually, you may not think very much of it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about AA, Alcoholics Anonymous at 75, and what we understand about the 12-step formula, why it works when it works. Brendan Kerner is with us from Wired Magazine, a big piece there on a headline, Secret of AA. After 75 years, we don't know how it works. We've got a couple of scientists with us as well who've spent a lot of time looking at this at the Public Health Institute's Alcohol Research Group. Leanne Cascudas joins us from Berkeley, California, and from the University of New Mexico, Scott Tonnegan joins us from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Lots of responses here and contributions online. Vicki brings us a quote from David Brooks, writing in the New York Times. He wrote, interestingly, in a culture that generally celebrates empowerment and self-esteem, AA begins with disempowerment. The goal is to get people to gain control over their lives, but it all begins with an act of surrender and an admission of weakness. This is the essence of AA, she writes. Can science conclude anything from this? Let us hold that question for a second, Vicki. Let's get a call from Lily in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Lily, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I love your show. I listen all the time, and I'm really happy that you're addressing this. And I'm both a member of a 12-step program and also a medical journalist, and I've done some research on the neuroscience of addiction. But based on my experience, you know, I think what's revolutionary about AA was making this connection that had never been made before between the spiritual and addiction. And I see being in a 12-step program as the same as living a spiritual life. And and following any spiritual practice takes enormous commitment. And it sort of goes against the grain of our whole culture, which you could say has a problem, a widespread problem with self-regulation at this point. And so that, you know, is not for everybody.
Well, you're a medical journalist, Lily, yeah. So how do you understand that spiritual part? Is there a scientific explanation for what it might bring to the party as far as you've found, or something else?
Well, there is evidence that, you know, spiritual practice can change brain chemistry. But I think that, you know, the effects of the spiritual are very hard to study, that there is an element of the metaphysical kind of is really sort of, I think, ultimately beyond the grasp of scientific study, and it's something that you have to feel and experience. And so that, you know, I don't know that how much, you know, research will really, how much it will, you know, be able to explain something that I think is not really kind of defies rational explanation, but that it does, it has the ability to really transform you and transform your whole, you on all levels, you know, spiritual, emotional and physical, and AA was the first to say that addiction is a spiritual, emotional, and physical condition, which was, you know, extraordinary 75 years ago.
Yeah. Lily, I appreciate your insight and you bringing your experience to us. Thanks for your call. Brendan, you know, what did you find on this front in your reporting? We'll go to our scientists, but Lily says maybe the metaphysical is beyond understanding. On the other hand, there you are talking to scientists, you know, sort of looking at the prefrontal cortex and a lot of very, very material biological aspects. Is there an intersection?
Well, I think there are some very pioneering efforts right now to understand how spirituality and spiritual experience alters neurochemistry. I do discuss in the piece a couple of brain scan studies looking at how meditation and prayer affect the brain and whether there's any difference in the brains of those who seem receptive to spiritual experiences versus those who are not. But as the caller said, you know, the great challenge of this piece was taking a scientific lens to a solution or a therapy that, because of its spiritual component, is kind of by its very nature non-scientific or metaphysical.
I want to take that to our scientists, but one more call first. Williamsburg, Virginia. Bill, you're on the air, Bill.
Hi, Tom. Really enjoy the show.
Thank
you. I want to preface this comment by saying I appreciate the work that AA has done in the lives of millions of people, and I think anything that helps people make their lives better is an admirable cause. You know, that said, I've struggled with alcoholism my entire adult life, been in and out of the justice system because of it, and have attended Alcoholic Anonymous meetings both as court-mandated treatment and on my own trying to get straight.
Yep.
You know, I have found the experience to be, at best, uninspiring and boring, and at its worst, offensive and almost cult-like. You know, at this point, I've been sober for 15 months. I've done it through what I think is a pretty traditional process. I woke up one morning after a bender, decided I didn't want to be that person anymore, reached out to my friends and family, told them where I was and what I was doing, and asked for their help and support. And have found, you know, at least for 15 months, that's been a pretty straightforward approach.
Well, Bill, let me ask you then, since you've been to the meetings, I mean, you've heard people calling in today saying how it worked for them. It didn't work for you. When you looked around the meetings, I'm sure you weren't the only one there. Could you kind of figure out, just as a layman, who it might be working for and who it might not?
Yeah, I saw clearly there were people for whom they were transferring the addiction, right? And not to get too far into pop psychology, but you know, for a lot of folks, they were clearly replacing the experience of alcohol, the euphoria, the camaraderie that they clearly found in and around drinking establishments,
yep.
All of which is very familiar to me.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to transfer that to the Alcoholic Anonymous group.
Is that a bad thing, a good thing? What do you make of it?
No, I think it's a neutral thing if it helps you stop drinking. I really do. I think, you know, certainly in my case, the comments earlier about the inability to control, that's really where my challenge with alcoholism is. I've got a great life and great friends and great family. I just don't know when one glass of wine is going to turn into 12.
And what about the metaphysical piece, Bill? Did that work for you? Do you turn to that with your own path here or not?
Yeah, you know, at the time I considered myself a Christian and regularly attended church. I very much found that, certainly in my experience in AA, that it was a gloss on top of something else that was happening. In other words, that this was a way of them explaining things that couldn't be explained. You know, since then, I've drifted completely away from the church and would call myself an atheist these days. And found that has not inhibited my ability to look beyond who I am and what's inside my control and ask for help from, you know, those around me. And sometimes it's as easy as making sure that when I visit friends, they have something to drink that's not a bottle of wine.
Bill, I hope you stay on the straight and narrow and joyful. It sounds like you've got the capacity to do all that, and I hope you pull it off, and I appreciate your perspective a lot. Let's go to our scientist here, Leanne Cascudas, first to you. I mean, this question about the metaphysical and whether there may be a scientific explanation for this AA emphasis on why that may help some, clearly not all, but it may help some people stay off alcohol. Is there a scientific explanation, a connection?
Well, the measures that we have for spirituality don't seem to do a real good, robust job, but we do in helping us understand definitively. Mm-hmm. But I've taken a different angle on it and looked at the AA steps and tried to see, well, now where's the spirituality there that I can study? And the 12th step talks about carrying the message to other alcoholics. And I think that one thing people underestimate the importance of, and I think it's a form of spirituality, is this idea of helping others.
Mm-hmm.
And early on, a newcomer can help others by doing little baby steps of service. Something as simple as putting their chair away and then maybe talking to someone as they're putting their chair away helps them get outside their own self-centeredness, makes them feel less loathsome of themselves, seeing that they can do something good. And it's a baby step, I admit it, but I think it accumulates over time. And over time, people become able to help others in bigger ways and become really good citizens of the world. And I think that the 12th step is really the wisdom. It's the internal combustion engine, I think, of AA that explains both why the organization grows like it does and is sustained and why it helps people.
Scott Tonnegan, it helps
yes.
Some, doesn't help others. What about the metaphysical piece and science?
Well, I think as has been mentioned earlier, you know, we have huge measurement challenges, and our misunderstandings of AA are very clear as researchers. For example, at the most basic level, it is popularly known as a self-help program, and I think most people in AA would say, no, self-help is what got us here. We are a mutual help program. And another measurement challenge is just simply the language system used within AA. For example, the often heard comment, keep coming back, can be a supportive encouraging statement for someone who's relatively new to AA, but spoken to someone who's been there 20 years can almost be a backhanded slap of you haven't quite gotten it yet.
Yeah.
But with that in mind, you know, I think at a minimum what we're beginning to see in the research is that if we step back and look at the practice of spirituality as a shared ideology among the social movement, within the social movement, that it serves as an adhesive or glue to keep people attending Alcoholics Anonymous. And clearly the attendance is predictive of positive outcome. And it hasn't come up quite yet, but somewhat indirectly through the earlier visitors to the calls. We know that those who become more actively involved, for example, fare better than those who simply attend. And by involvement, I mean having a sponsor. We know that at least in early efforts to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous the first 6 months, that your likelihood of abstinence increases threefold by having a sponsor.
We've heard testimony from callers to that and from Bill N., who's done it for 20 years, about that working. We've got all kinds of response here. If I may, here's a comment from Facebook from Kevin, who says, one thing AA has over all other treatment programs, it costs nothing. That's got to be to have advantages to it. But here's another from Mari. And I wonder where you put this, Brendan. She says, AA at 75 has not aged well, in my opinion. I've seen AA used as a cover for all sorts of bad behavior. The 13th step is often the only one that many male members adhere to religiously, that is, sexually preying upon young female newcomers who have been recently persuaded that they are completely powerless. And then she says, I've also seen many people use AA as an elite social club, depending on where the group meetings are held. What about those, Brendan?
Yeah, that's a big problem. There's really no quality control in AA. It's the organizational principle behind AA is deliberate anarchy, in that when they were deciding how to grow the organization in the 40s, they decided to make it as easy as possible for anyone to start a meeting. And so there are, as we said at the beginning, there's 55,000 meetings, and there's tremendous variety in those meetings. And one of the big problems, as that commenter said, is that some of these meetings are attended by people with very nefarious intentions. And 13th stepping, as she says, is common. And you have old-timers who belittle and domineer over the newcomers. And you have all sorts of problems in certain meetings. And I think that that's, you know, some people will go to a meeting and figure out it's not for them because of those problems and try another. Some people will go to a meeting a couple times and face those problems and never try it again.
Let's go to Malibu, California. Hector in Malibu, you're on the air.
Hi, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been in and out of, in very high-end rehabs, and I've also been on the East Coast where I used to live. And I have found them tremendously helpful in the beginning, but after a couple of years, I found them to be draining, simply because I couldn't get outside of the meeting to extend my life beyond to friends or family. And people look down at you if you, especially within the culture of AA, if you were to sort of go outside of AA.
You mean it sort of took over your life, you were finding, Hector, in a way?
Yeah, I seriously found it to be sort of like it was my shackle. It was like I became dependent. If anything, the irony was that I became addicted to the meetings. I was going every day doing the 90-90. I was going to the CMA, the NA, the AA, and I found them really wonderful. But then later on, I also have to state that there's a huge culture difference, obviously, between East Coast and West Coast in the way the meetings and the formats are run. And primarily the reason I moved out here really to the West Coast was essentially because I found recovery out here much more conducive to my own recovery and to the longevity of my own sobriety.
Are you in AA now or not? And are you sober now or not, Hector?
I'm sober, and I am a card carrying member of all three. But I have to state that I do not attend regularly and faithfully every day or five times or four times a week.
All right, Hector, finding your own way, and we hope you stay on it successfully. One more. Thank you, Hector, in Malibu. Charleston, South Carolina, other side of the country. Jim, we've just got a minute, but you're on, my friend.
Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been sober for 38 years. I got sober when I was a senior in college, and came in because my parents had gotten sober through Alcoholics Anonymous in Akron, Ohio in 1966. I have to say one thing, that it's a program of attraction rather than promotion. You've definitely got to want to stay sober, and you've got to want this program, and you've got to be willing to go to any length to do this. I continue to go to meetings 3 days a week, not because I have to, but because I want to.
And it's helped you. And there you are to tell us about it. Bill, I appreciate that. Our time is short. Scott Tonnegan, is there ever going to be something simpler in our consumer society? I mean, I know there are drugs out there, but they don't seem entirely successful. Is it conceivable there could one day be a pill that people take and their alcohol desire is gone, or even, you know, the reverse?
Well, certainly there are already FDA-approved medications to assist someone to achieve abstinence. Naltrexone comes to mind most quickly. But on the other hand, I think even the drug manufacturers realize that it's going to be a parallel process of medications and social support, because as you've heard in the guest speakers today that, you know, really people come to AA, they've exhausted their social support for abstinence, and many even might come in with social support for drinking. And the AA environment provides that support that people require. Even the gentleman who earlier said that he was unsuccessful in AA alluded to the fact that his family offered the kind of support that was helpful to him. One day it might occur, but I think we find that as people are saying that, or have been saying, is sometimes it's not so much a drinking problem but a living problem, and that the group provides that assistance to them.
Fascinating. Brendan, what did you come away with thinking? Another 75 years, we're still going to have AA?
I think we will. I just want to say one thing that's been a couple of callers mentioned is that Bill Wilson wanted AA to be a replacement addiction by design. He was very influenced by William James, who said the only cure for a dipsomania is religiomania. And that was really part of one of the core principles
the
Bill Wilson
concept.
Brought to the 12 steps.
Brendan Kerner with Wired, Scott Tonnegan, University of New Mexico, Leanne Cascudas in Berkeley. Thanks to each of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.